This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Lily Brooks Dalton, author of the novel The Light Pirate.
I've gotten better at trusting that there is an intuitive answer to most questions that I have. And I've gotten pretty good at practicing by asking questions that don't matter too much.
We'll be back with Lily Brooks Dalton after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Lily Brooks Dalton, author of the novel Good Morning Midnight, which has been translated into 17 languages and was the inspiration for the film adaptation The Midnight Sky. Her memoir, Motorcycles I've Loved, was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award. Her new novel, The Light Pirate, was a runner-up for the Dayton Literary Prize, a Good Morning America Book Club selection, and a New York Times editor's pick. Her novel, The Light Pirate, takes place in southern Florida as devastating weather patterns and rising sea levels wreak havoc on the state's infrastructure. When the novel opens, a powerful hurricane is approaching a small coastal town where Kirby Lowe and his wife Frida live with their two sons. Frida is pregnant and goes into premature labor alone in the home while Kirby is out looking for their two sons who have gone missing. The baby Frida gives birth to is named Wanda after the catastrophic hurricane that changed society and the Lowe family forever. The novel follows Wanda as she grows into adulthood while society unravels to the point where survival is up to each individual. Wanda learns to adapt to the watery world and makes peace with special powers that she possesses but doesn't completely understand. We began the discussion with me asking Lily Brooks Dalton about her inspiration to write a book that focused on climate change.
I'm not sure that I knew I was writing a book about climate change when I started the book. I knew that I was writing a book that was using the drama and the momentum of a hurricane to propel the plot. And I knew that I was writing about line workers. And between those two topics, it gradually became clear to me that, of course, it was a book about climate change. And I had to kind of catch up to that, the fact that that was already underway. And once I started being more cognizant of what the book wanted to be and where it was headed, it really started to unfold in some really surprising directions and just sort of take on a mind of its own, which was exciting to see.
What do you think about that aspect of being an artist where you were saying it took a while for you to catch up to the fact that it was about climate change? So it was like, not that it was writing itself, it wasn't. And you said, you know, you had interest in people who work on electric lines and the hurricane. So there was something there. But what was that like? How did you know when that moment arrived? And what do you think about that in creativity?
I think about that a lot, actually, because I definitely don't mean to suggest that I'm not, that like my books kind of, it's a balance, right? Like the book does tell me what it's about, but I'm also very focused on an outline and sort of planning how the plot is going to unfold. And I've never really been able to just set a character loose and let them show me how the book works, you know? And I feel like I've heard other writers kind of talk about that being part of their process of letting the characters show them who they are. And I realize I just said something kind of, you know, close to that, but I'm also, because I do think there's something very intuitive about writing and just feeling into what is unfolding in an organic way and what is kind of biting you and blocking you and making those discernments between what's a wall you need to push through and what is a path that's begging you to walk down it. But so it's a little of both. I mean, I definitely rely heavily on outlines and on sort of logicking my way through plot. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't feel right, I don't think it's going to read right. So yeah, it's an interesting balance.
Do you remember what your interest was in hurricanes and linemen, like people who work on electric lines?
Yeah. So someone in my family is a lineman. And so that was a really big part of my interest in that. And just feeling really proud of what they do and wanting to learn more about it. And the more that I learned about it, the more fascinated I became in the work that linemen do, or line workers do generally, but also specifically in Florida. It's a really, really interesting environment to be doing that job in. And then in terms of hurricanes, I was doing a residency in Key West at the studios of Key West. And there was a hurricane coming in. And, you know, I was watching the whole island kind of prepare for this and seeing the drama in it, and feeling very caught up in it myself as I was, like, you know, obsessively checking the weather reports and following its path. But also kind of being really curious about that rhythm of preparation and this really visceral sense of this happens all the time. And it is dramatic, but it's also so well-worn, this process of preparation. And I just became really compelled by that environment where that is necessary.
Is that why in the acknowledgments at the back, you say that you went to work on a different novel that gave rise to this one? Is that literally because you were in Key West writing something else and then you started watching that and it overtook your creative motivations?
Yeah, totally. I mean, on the flip side, I think that the book I was working on was not ready, not fully formed. I was trying to only have that intuitive piece of the writing process to, like, start with this idea and just go forth and write a book. And I couldn't make it work because I hadn't done that piece, that logic piece of thinking about, okay, this is a cool idea, but how is it a book? How does the plot work? And so, yeah, those pages are in a drawer somewhere, and someday I might go back to them. But it was easier to let it go once I had this other idea come knocking.
Once you realized that it was about climate change, did that sort of make you any more nervous because of the dialogue that's going on in our society, or because you sort of realized, like, this was an opportunity to really look at something that's the biggest threat to our existence in your fiction, and, like, just the weight of that?
Well, I started writing this book in 2016. And so obviously we were talking about climate change at that point, but the collective conversation was really different than it is right now. And in the years that I was writing, and in the years since I finished, I think the conversation has become even bigger and taken on even more weight. So I'm not sure how it would change the writing process if I had started it later or if I was working on it now. It felt like a really imperative topic for me. The deeper into the book I got, it felt both very difficult and grief-stricken to be thinking about it every day, all day, but it also felt like a coping mechanism in a way to be thinking about it every day, all day, because I think part of what is happening with this conversation around climate change is that when we don't talk about it and when we don't think about it, it isn't not a part of our days. You know, it isn't not weighing on us in a certain way. And I think something so massive and so important, if it's not being given that attention, it squirts out sideways. You know, it's like an ice cream sandwich or something. It's not, it's still there. So I think for me, it felt very correct to be giving it that kind of attention.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking about the plot of your book and how it goes. And we'll get into some of it in a minute. This just popped into my head, and you can tell me if it sounds crazy or not. But it seems like, in a way, and maybe this is how it will be when we're sinking and all of our cities are underwater, or when we're just dealing with the after effects, is that it seems like at first it's a man versus nature, like that plot device you hear. And then it's nature versus man or woman or whatever you identify as. And then it becomes more of a nature with humankind, humankind with nature. That I'll explain that in a minute, but how does that sound?
Yeah, I like that. I think that's true. I wouldn't have thought about it in those terms, but I think that's very apt and an interesting way to think about the progression of the book. And really the progression of, I think, you know, our civilization and the way that we treat land and nature. I think, you know, we've been really focused on battling against it and fitting it into the shapes that we would prefer it be in. You know, Florida as a place, as an ecological system, has fallen very much victim to that kind of damage that we've done. And so, yeah, to me, the later parts of this timeline you've set out are kind of how I imagine we might begin to recover from all this damage that we've done.
The Light Pirate focuses really most of the story on Wanda, but when we open, Wanda is not born yet. We meet Kirby and Frida, and they're married, newly married. Frida is pregnant, and Kirby has two young sons from his first marriage, and this storm called Wanda is coming. It's a hurricane, and they're like getting ready for it, and they've been through many. And Frida just can't shake this feeling like that it's going to be really bad, and she kind of wants to leave. And Kirby's like, it's going to be fine. I know what to do. We got the sandbags. I'm good. And he's a lineman. He goes out and fixes the electric lines, especially after these storms. And Frida ends up giving birth to Wanda, who's born during this hurricane that's called Wanda. And she becomes the main protagonist of the book. And we're sort of watching as the impacts of climate change get more severe and more severe, her life with Kirby, and how they both sort of manage and maintain to survive. I mean, this is the apocalyptic world, right? Where they're having more fires in California and Florida's underwater, and whole towns, like people who live in Miami have been supported in leaving, but people in rural areas are sort of left behind, which you can imagine. And there's no government structure. Society is broken down. And eventually it's really Wanda on her own sort of dealing with this watery world. And she also has a mentor and good friend and a neighbor named Phyllis, who was a scientist who sort of takes her in when she's about 12 and is Phyllis is a survivalist. So Wanda learns so much from her about science and fact and survival, but it's really her against this watery world as everything we know it has broken down. So when I say, like, at first it seems like it's man versus nature, when it opens, Frida's really worried. She has this premonition, but Kirby's like, it's going to be fine. And that's how so many people are. It's so hard for them to accept leaving your home when a storm is coming. We think that we are stronger or smarter than a storm, and that with enough sandbags, we're just going to be fine, and that we can prevail. But that is not what happened. So that is sort of the mind frame that you were dealing with in the beginning of the book.
Yeah, very much so. And I think what I really wanted to do was paint a number of portraits of these different characters responding to this disastrous situation that we're all in very different ways. And I'm not really interested in placing a value judgment on any of them. I'm interested in the diversity of them, the variations of how people are engaging with this sense of doom, you know. And Kirby is very set on the world as it is, the world as he grew up in it as he understands it, maintaining the status quo and focusing on the problems that are in front of him. And in that sense, climate change, the fact that things are getting worse and are not staying the same, is simply beyond the scope of what he's comfortable dealing with. He doesn't want to think about politics. He doesn't want to think about the wider world. He doesn't want to think about weather patterns changing. He wants to think about sandbags and how many he needs and where to stack them. And that is how he deals with fear and with his own life.
And then you have his wife, who's feeling something different. You know, she's feeling this own weather system in her own being. And she's also dealt with loss. She lost her mother through similar weather patterns. Mm-hmm. And it does really capture, though, how hard it is to leave, like how hard it is for our brains to accept this change. I mean, probably the younger people today who grew up with climate change as part of their curriculum, but we didn't. And mm-hmm. I think that just trying to grasp that we have to let go of our entire paradigm of how society works and the idea of permanence is so much to grasp.
Totally. It's seismic, you know, and I think that's part of why we're seeing such difficulty around people acknowledging the problem at all, because once you acknowledge it, I mean, it's such a big one to wrap your head around, and the solution is even bigger. Yeah, it makes sense to me that people are really, really committed to looking away.
I think too, there's also something in our brain that it's so hard to accept or really like grok and take in what we might really know inside. You have a line in the very beginning of the book where you're talking about Frida and her fear of the storm and her just feeling her strong sense that they should be leaving. But you wrote that maybe it was anxiety masquerading as intuition. You know, some of us are more in tune with our intuition, but by its very nature, intuition isn't science. It's not mm-hmm. something that you can prove. So when you are feeling really anxious about something, it's so hard to know. Like, I just think you tapped into something so elemental and so terrifying at the same time.
Totally. I think about this a lot in terms of writing, but also just in the minutiae of living my life. You know, how do I tell the difference between this incredible built-in tool that we all have, and maybe some of us exercise it more than others if we think of it as a muscle. Like, how do we tell the difference between that and this sort of white noise of our brains and the environments that surround us? Sometimes it feels like they're operating on the same frequency and they're fighting for airtime, and there's not always a crisp line between them, you know, but I like that you pulled forth that theme. That's something I think about a lot.
Have you figured anything out about it?
I think I've gotten better at it. For sure. I think that I've kind of learned that I've gotten better at trusting that there is an intuitive answer to most questions that I have. And I've gotten pretty good at practicing by asking questions that don't matter too much, you know, questions that are really small. And it's kind of instilled in me a greater, I guess I'll use the word faith, even though that makes me feel a little bit itchy, but in bigger questions. So I think that I've learned that yeses and nos kind of feel different in my body, and that's been a helpful thing to understand about it. But yeah, this is... I don't have it solved. No, definitely not.
is that something that you lean into? Like how intuitive is your writing process? I mean, you say you outline, so what is the relationship between intuition and outlining?
Well, intuition is definitely part of outlining too. You know, I think it comes into that part of the process also, very much so, in fact. You know, if I'm thinking through, okay, plot wise, I can take a left, I can take a right, or I can go straight. And like either whichever direction I choose will fundamentally change the shape of the book. So I have to pick right. Otherwise, I'm going to be headed down the wrong road for who knows how many pages and we'll have to backtrack. That's a moment where I pull back and I put on my kind of outlining hat and I think through each of those decisions. And sometimes it's just a logic choice. You know, it becomes clear, okay, if I go in this direction, this isn't going to get me someplace that I want to go. But sometimes they're just different. They're just different roads and there is no value attached to them. One is not better than the other, or one is not more aligned with the vision that I have than the other. And so then it becomes a question of intuition and like what the intuitive choice is.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In the first, I guess, plot-wise part of the book, you know, the storm comes, Wanda is born, and they're kind of dealing with some immediate things that happen in the aftermath. And then we move ahead to Wanda being like 10, 11, 12 years old with her family. And at this point is where, you know, you write about the structure of civilization is deteriorating. So like people aren't going to school and people have been leaving Miami and there's no, you know, the electricity, there's no one to pay in the town to even pay Kirby for his lineman work. But he just kind of goes to work because he wants to restore the electricity as long as he can. And you write, what will it take to save it? And at that point, you're talking about the town government and the town budget so that at least their town of Rudder can continue to go on. But you're also really talking about planet Earth. And I'm curious, as you started down this road of writing about this deteriorating society and everything we know being sort of gone from beneath our feet, you know, you mentioned, you know, grief and writing about this. And I'm just wondering, like, how you imagine this, which probably wasn't that as hard to imagine as, like, how you dealt with writing about it every day.
That's a good question. And it's something I think about a lot because I, for whatever reason, continue to write difficult things. I think the salves and the balms for this kind of work for me are very small. They lie in taking care of other living things, I think is probably the easiest way to sum that up. You know, taking my time watering my plants and checking that they have what they need, taking care of my creature, my pet, taking care of the relationships in my life, making sure that my loved ones feel loved, taking care of my body, myself. Maybe another way to sum that up is just extending care in the face of something that feels really unmanageable, just starting small.
Do you think that there's some kind of boomerang effect too with how that comes back in the story or the writing, that it provides some hope. I mean, no one is obligated to write a climate change story that has hope. You can choose to have it or not, but I think your story has hope. And I'm wondering about if that helps you create hope or if that makes you create hope.
Yeah, a little of both. It's interesting. I feel like the form of a book feels, and the length of a book feels really important to me in terms of getting to that hope. You know, 300 pages is a long time to kind of give due deference to the feelings of grief and doom and hopelessness. And that to me feels equally as important as threading in this other stream of hope. You know, I think on the occasions when I've been invited to speak about the book or, you know, about writing in some way, it's been a really interesting challenge to condense that process into whatever time is allotted, you know, to kind of try and get through all the things that are so difficult and hard to think about in order to try and gift the audience with this kernel of hope at the end. And it almost feels insurmountable to me sometimes. And so I guess that's why I write books, because there's something really that feels really dishonest and even sadder to me about presenting unearned hope, or trying to like tie a bow really fast before the grief has been fully witnessed and unpacked. So yeah, they have to go together, I think.
In a way, what you're saying, or how I perceive it, is like you are creating a relationship with your reader. Like you are not separate from understanding the emotional journey that this reader is on. I mean, yes, you have to have the sentence level, you have to have the plot, but there's some other resonance you're talking about being the caretaker for.
Absolutely. And so I think, you know, that's another layer of that, of the answer to a previous question about like, how does one take care of themselves while doing this kind of thing? And it's like, well, that part of that is woven into the work itself. Like I'm endeavoring to show the reader something really hard and ask them to sit with it and also give them something to take away from it that is a little bit brighter and a little bit easier to hold. And that's for me too. That's something I'm creating for myself also as I go.
So Wanda, the main character, has a supernatural element to her, which is when she does get in the water, she creates this light, this luminosity. It's almost as if she, like what trails behind her is bioluminescence, or like seeing the northern lights inside of the water. She creates light, and I envision it like this sparkly thing that when you witness it, you feel it in your body. It's just so special. And, you know, Phyllis, the woman she's with for a while, who's a scientist, can't really explain it. And it also brings, I think, some cellular healing to things in the water, like allows things to maybe rejuvenate in a new way. And I was curious about coming up with this element and adding something that's supernatural into a story like this.
Yeah, it was a later addition for sure. Initially, when I was working on the opening section, I envisioned Wanda picking up her father's torch and, you know, literally continuing to keep the lights on by way of pirating electricity from neighboring areas, or I hadn't quite figured it out yet, but I was very much, my brain was very much in the track of electricity. And then something shifted for me, and I started to realize that I wanted the later sections of the book to be rooted in something more organic, something of that ecosystem, rather than being kind of imposed upon it in this sort of human human way. It was tricky to introduce that element into the book at that point. It felt, I was really conflicted about it. I wasn't sure if it was going to work or if I was allowed to do that or, you know, but in the end, it just felt like actually maybe the story needed that ethereal element, that sort of supernatural, as you said, flavor of something that exists outside of what is explainable, and that could pay homage to all the things that we don't understand, you know. And I was really interested in having Phyllis there, who is a scientist and who's very engaged in the environment, but in what she can learn about the environment, what she can understand about it, and who is really, really struggles in the face of this thing that she doesn't have an answer for. That tension to me was really interesting, and became a larger theme in the book.
I loved Wanda's relationship with Phyllis. It was very sweet, and it was really, in the end, I think Phyllis gave her all of the tools that she needed to survive, and not just survive, but thrive. Well, Phyllis is a survivalist. And so her, you know, she had canned food, she had stockpiles of things, she had guns, she had solar power, she had everything she needed because she saw what was coming. And she took action like so many people don't. Like, I think you have a line in there that says, yeah, I think it was maybe Kirby you were referring to, or you said, didn't he see it coming? Didn't everyone? They've known for years, decades. And we can know something, but again, having to act on it. But Phyllis was an actor, and she really gave Wanda all the tools she needed to outlive her, really.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite relationships in the book. And I was really, I was and am really interested in the different ways that we pass on knowledge, pass on resources, pass on tools that aren't bound up in blood and lineage. You know, I wanted to create this kind of evolutionary possibility for passing things on in other ways. And that was kind of at the root of thinking through that relationship and creating this person in Wanda's life who becomes so important to her and is not bound to her by relation, but is bound to her by something else. Yeah, I there's just something really powerful to me in that kind of relationship.
If it's true that the book progressed from man versus nature to nature versus man or human, that this is the point where in the book, the nature was taking over. The nature was sinking society. The nature was getting, you know, flooding everything. The nature was eventually making it, you know, if you're a survivalist, even if you're the best survivalist, you probably can't last forever. Like, your food's going to run out. Your bullets are going to run out. In this case, like, they couldn't really have gardens anymore because everything was just so wet and swampy. They could fish, but there is a time when nature's still going to take over. So then the question is, which I got out of, you know, the end, is like, okay, how do you then try to form a life where you can still be a human being and not turn into a predator of other humans? Mm-hmm. And find a harmony with the new way of being.
You know, I think there is a demand for adaptability in that unfolding. You know, like, yes, Phyllis is prepared in XYZ ways. And that is really imperative in bridging that gap between the way that the world was and the way that it becomes. But eventually, a bridge is not enough. Like, the systems that she has in place in order to survive become obsolete. And so it becomes a question of how to make new systems, like how life will look in the future not what version of life in the past can continue if everything around us changes, which is so much of what survivalism is about, right? It's about stockpiling resources that we use now that are important to us now. It's about doing whatever preparatory things we can in order to maintain a certain lifestyle should the environment that surrounds us become incredibly different, right? If those things are no longer available. And that makes total sense and is not wrong, but at a certain point, you have to kind of ask, like, if the environment that surrounds us becomes irrevocably different, then the way that we live has to become different too. And so what does that look like?
Yeah. And I think the last part of the book was so much about changing the paradigm. I mean, literally you have a line where, you know, when eventually Wanda ends up on her own because she's, you know, Phyllis is much older and we're seeing a long span of Wanda's life. So Phyllis isn't alive anymore. And one of the things that was really important to Phyllis to teach Wanda, and it totally made sense, especially in the beginning, was that part of survival is safety. Like you can't, they're linked and you have to be like on your guard all the time to make sure you're being safe. And there's a point where Wanda's wondering, what if survival and risk belong to one another? Because she had to change her paradigm. Like she couldn't, as life continued in this wet and watery world, if she was safe all the time, then she would just be like by herself. And at some point, she had to either interact with people or at least interface with them to go out and fish and do the things she didn't need to eat and survive. And so that, to me, was like both sort of a turning point in philosophy of the book that it was offering, and also maybe the point where we actually saw her become an adult.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way that you put all of that, because I do think that that transition for Wanda from, you know, operating from a place of really pure fear, and allowing in something else, the possibility that a risk could equal something good rather than the conviction that a risk equals something very bad, is like a really formative and core piece of her personal evolution. And I think is part of what I wanted the entire book to convey too, not that there is no place for that kind of fear, but that it can't only be fear. There has to be the possibility for something more.
Because your book covered so much time, I mean, from before the birth of Wanda into her old age, I'm wondering how you, I mean, I know because I read the book, like how you dealt with time over the course of a book, how you deal with that long of time. And some of it is through the structure. You had four sections: power, water, light, and time. And generally you move forward in time, but there's also things that you just say that happen off the page. So just curious how you think about managing time in fiction.
I'm a big fan of containers, you know? And so for me, the container for this book was Wanda's lifetime. And once I kind of decided on that, it became easier to think about how to organize time within that structure. Overlaying that, the different sections in the book were another way of further organizing within that structure. And part of my thought process there was I wanted to give each section space to move differently. So in Power, the first section, which is focused on the hurricane that unfolds as Wanda's being born, the tempo of the writing is very quick. It's like these staccato chapters. It's very interested in its own momentum. And then when we switch into Water, the writing becomes a little more spacious and the plot is moving in a more gradual way to kind of mirror this idea of like a rising sea level. And then in Light, this sort of more ethereal quality to Wanda's Wanda's power and how that affects the book is coming into play. And so the narrative is given this ability to move through time in a different way, to have both a past and a present storyline, and to pair those two. And then in the final section, time, we jump really far ahead and we're kind of toward the end of Wanda's life and thinking in a much more expansive way about time in the past and time moving forward, and just getting a much more expansive view of that. So yeah, those are kind of the main decisions that I made in terms of organizing the book around time.
Well, another thing that you do structurally throughout the book, and I think you always do it when you're getting to a new section, but sometimes you also do it amidst a section, is you have a more poetic, kind of more distant, much more distant prose section that's in italics, that in some ways it's not like nature talking, but it could be like nature talking. It's just a much bigger view. Like this one is really short, where you say, "The light flows in every direction. It is composed of many minds, many eyes. It is one creature and it is many, an awareness that grows and deepens, an intelligence that is made to join and join and join. This is how life began. This is how it goes on living." So it's like a little bit philosophical. It's poetic. It's not like part of the storytelling per se. You're not like in a character's head. Can you talk about that?
Yes, totally. Yeah, those sections, what I wanted to do is kind of give each section its own elemental voice, if you will, in order to create a different gaze on the story that's happening, like a much more macroscopic view on the plot that's unfolding. And it was an interesting process figuring out that I wanted to do that, and then also figuring out how to make those sort of interstitial sections work. I think in earlier drafts, they were like pretty overwrought and like, and hopefully less so now. But you know, there were moments where they were working less well than others. And at a certain point, I had a good friend of mine who was generous enough to read a draft suggest to me that maybe, like, what would the book look like without them? And I so value her opinion. And so I thought about that for a long time. And I could see where she was coming from, but it ended up sending me in the other direction of being like, okay, if these aren't working, I need to rework them because they're actually so important to the book.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influences you as a writer?
Yes. So I picked a passage from Written on the Body by Jeanette Winterson, who's one of my favorite writers. And this is definitely one of my favorite books. And I decided I wanted to take something from this book, but I didn't know which passage. And as I was flipping through, I was just kind of overwhelmed because literally any paragraph blows me away. But this is what I picked. I didn't only want Louise's flesh. I wanted her bones, her blood, her tissues, the sinews that bound her together. I would have held her to me through time, though time had stripped away the tones and textures of her skin. I could have held her for 1,000 years until the skeleton itself rubbed away to dust. What are you that makes me feel thus? Who are you for whom time has no meaning? In the heat of her hands, I thought, this is the campfire that mocks the sun. This place will warm me, feed me, and care for me. I will hold on to this pulse against other rhythms. The world will come and go in the tide of a day, but here is her hand with my future in its palm. Oh my God, it's so good. But yeah, I wanted to, I don't know, it was easy. This is a fun exercise to just kind of roam around and look at my bookshelves. And as soon as I saw written on the body, I was like, oh, well, that one, obviously. I think there's something so difficult in describing things like love and passion and lust in a way that feels fresh and engaging and exciting. And Jeanette Winterson does that so, so well.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft or something you really like?
Yes. So I picked something from The Light Pirate. I picked one of these italicized interstitial passages that we were talking about. This one is from Water. This is kind of the introductory passage before the section Water begins. And I picked it because the transition for me between Power, the first section, and Water, the second, was so difficult. I was really stumped for a long time in the drafting process. It felt like I was starting a completely different book and I didn't know how to do that. And so this is kind of the moment when I figured out that I wanted to do these passages throughout. And it's the moment that I figured out that if I could do these passages, I could essentially create the sense of continuity while still allowing each section to be really different and to have these gaps of time separating them. If I was always coming back to some form of an elemental voice, it just felt like the connective tissue that kind of kept the book together. So this is that passage. If the ocean is a body, then the waves are its tongue, long and blue-gray, licking at the beach until there's nothing left. This body is wide and full and deep. It rises, wrapping itself around the world, squeezing the land tight between its thighs. 10 years means nothing to a body like this. It's been here since the beginning.
Do you want to say anything else about that, or you're good?
I guess another reason that I chose it, as I had chosen written on the body first, and then I was like, bodies, more bodies. So I think that was on my mind. And thinking about, I don't know, there's something in this book about, you know, it builds towards a queer love story. And of all the things that are difficult and heartbreaking about the book, the queerness is not one of them. And I think a lot about like the ways in which nature feels very queer to me. And this idea of like an elemental voice or a body that is not a human body feels like this kind of, I don't know, something queer about that. And Jeanette Winterson is such a genius about kind of writing outside the heteronormative lines. So these two just felt like they went together in an interesting way.
Where do you write?
So I write mostly on my couch, which is a shame because I have a really beautiful writing desk and I think my chronic back pain would improve if I used it more often. But I'll write in bed sometimes also if I feel like I really need that additional layer of safety. I will definitely revise at my desk, but there is something about being in a soft place when I'm drafting that feels important.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I love to take walks. I'm a big walker. People say that people don't walk in LA, but that is just not the case. I'm a really big fan of walking in LA, and I think it's actually a pretty extraordinary place to walk when you can, roam through 4 or 5 neighborhoods in a 5-mile radius and just like see how different this place can be. And I like to play video games. So sometimes in the afternoon, when I hit a wall with writing, I will either put on my sneakers and go for a long walk, or I'll play a video game, or both.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
It depends. I think it depends on the work, and it depends on where the work is in its evolution, and it depends on where I am. Sometimes I'll show it to my agent first, who I've worked with for a long time. Sometimes I'll show it to my girlfriend first. Sometimes I'll show it to my mom first. So I think it depends.
How have you dealt with rejection?
With difficulty. I don't think there's any easy way to deal with rejection, but I do think it's one of those things that maybe gets a little easier, or can get easier. I think there's probably an alternate universe in which it just gets harder and harder if you're getting really stuck. I think for me, I've gotten to a place with rejection where, as difficult as it is, it also feels like more information being added to my map. And so when I get a no, it's just like, okay, this road is closed to me. Thank you for the information. I guess I'm headed in this direction. And I mean, this is like a very rosy and not always possible way of looking at it, but I do think there can be relief in like, oh, well, that is a clear path I cannot take. So I guess I have learned something about what path I can and should take. So I don't know. That feeling is not always accessible, but I find that it helps.
And what is your favorite word?
Well, my favorite word tends to change, I think. I don't have an all-time favorite, but lately, I've really been preoccupied with how much I love the word lunch. I love to eat lunch, and I love to say lunch, and it's just a really good one.
Do you have a writing tip you could share?
Yes, I think that a writing tip that I come back to again and again is typing from scratch, and I'll often do this with my own draft. Either when I am hopelessly stuck, or more often when I'm ready to revise. There is something really valuable, and I can't find the word I'm looking for, but by printing out what I have and literally retyping, I am forced to confront every sentence anew and to really be honest with myself about whether it's needs to be there, whether it's just like okay or good enough, whether it could be better, and in a way that I feel like I doesn't feel as accessible when I'm just like weaving and bobbing in a Word document that already exists.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm so honored. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitzi. This was really fun.
If you like today's show with Lily Brooks Dalton, author of the novel The Light Pirate, check out my interview with Karen Thompson Walker, author of the novel The Age of Miracles. We talked about turning short stories into novels, working in publishing, and creating a speculative story that feels realistic rather than science fiction. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look for First Draft, ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Steve Almond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft a dialogue on writing a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.